Chapter 2. Presently my father's face softened somewhat, and he said, "Go and try. But mind, curb folly. No poetry at the expense of truth. Keep strictly to the facts." I said I would, and bowed myself out, and went upstairs. Hiawatha kept droning in my head, and so did my father's remarks about the sublimity and romance hidden in my subject, and also his injunction to beware of wasteful and exuberant fancy. I noticed, just here, that I had heedlessly brought the deed away with me. Now at this moment, came to me one of those rare moods of daring recklessness, such as I referred to a while ago. Without another thought, and in plain defiance of the fact that I knew my father meant me to write the romantic story of my half-dashed brother's adventure and subsequent good fortune, I ventured to heed merely the letter of his remarks, and ignore their spirit. I took the stupid, arranty deed itself, and chopped it up into Iaathi in blank verse without altering or leaving out three words, and without transposing six. It required loads of courage to go downstairs, and face my father with my performance. I started three or four times, before I finally got my pluck to where it would stick. But at last I said I would go down, and read it to him, if he threw me over the church for it. I stood up to begin, and he told me to come closer. I edged up a little, but still left as much neutral ground between us as I thought he would stand. Then I began. It would be useless for me to try to tell what conflicting emotions expressed themselves upon his face, nor how they grew more and more intense as I proceeded, nor how a fell darkness descended upon his countenance, and he began to gag and swallow, and his hands began to work and twitch, as I reeled off line after line, with the strength ebbing out of me, and my legs trembling under me. The story of a gallant deed, this indenture, made the 10th day of November, in the year of our Lord 1856, between Joanna S. E. Gray and Philip Gray, her husband, of Salem City in the state of Texas, of the first part, and O.B. Johnson, of the town of Austin, ditto, witnesseth. That said party of first part, for and in consideration of the sum of $20,000, lawful money of the U.S. of America, to them in hand now paid by said party of the second part, the due receipt whereof is hereby confessed, and acknowledged having granted, bargained, sold, remissed, released and aliened and conveyed, confirmed, and by these presents, do grant and bargain, sell, remise, alien, release, convey, and con-firm unto the said aforesaid party of the second part, unto his heirs, and assigns forever and ever all that certain lot or parcel of land situate in city of Dunkirk, county of Chautauqua, and likewise furthermore in New York State, bounded and described, to wit, as follows, herein, namely beginning at the distance of 842 feet, north half east, northeast by north, east northeast and northerly of the northerly line of Mulligan Street on the westerly line of Brannigan Street, and running thence due northerly on Brannigan Street 200 feet, thence at right angles westerly, northwest by west and west half west, west and by north, northwest by west, about, I kind of dodged, and the bootjack broke the looking glass. I could have waited to see what became of the other missiles, if I had wanted to, but I took no interest in such things. Introductory to Emeranda and taking upon myself the burden of editing a department in the Galaxy magazine, I have been actuated by a conviction that I was needed, almost imperatively, in this particular field of literature. I have long felt that, while the magazine literature of the day had much to recommend it, it yet lacked stability, solidity, weight. It seemed plain to me that too much space was given to poetry and romance, and not enough to statistics and agriculture. This defect it shall be my earnest endeavor to remedy. If I succeed, the simple consciousness that I have done a good deed will be a sufficient reward, together with salary. In this department of mine, the public may always rely upon finding exhaustive statistical tables concerning the finances of the country, the ratio of births and deaths, the percentage of increase of population, etc., etc. In a word, everything in the realm of statistics that can make existence bright and beautiful. Also, in my department will always be found elaborate condensations of the patent office reports, wherein a faithful endeavor will at all times be made to strip the nutritious facts bare of that effulgence of imagination and sublimity of diction which too often mar the excellence of those great works. N. B. No other magazine in the country makes a specialty of the patent office reports. In my department, will always be found ample excerpts from those able dissertations upon political economy which I have for a long time been contributing to a great metropolitan journal, and which, for reasons utterly incomprehensible to me, another party has chosen to usurp the credit of composing. And, finally, I call attention with pride to the fact that in my department of the magazine the farmer will always find full market reports, and also complete instructions about farming, even from the grafting of the seed to the harrowing of the matured crop. I shall throw a pathos into the subject of agriculture that will surprise and delight the world. Such is my program. And I am persuaded that by adhering to it with fidelity I shall succeed in materially changing the character of this magazine. Therefore I am emboldened to ask the assistance and encouragement of all whose sympathies are with progress and reform. In the other departments of the magazine will be found poetry, tales, and other frothy trifles, and to these the reader can turn for relaxation from time to time, and thus guard against overstraining the powers of his mind. MTPS 1. I have not sold out of the Buffalo Express, and shall not, neither shall I stop writing for it. This remark seems necessary in a business point of view. 2. These memoranda are not a humorous department. I would not conduct an exclusively and professedly humorous department for anyone. I would always prefer to have the privilege of printing a serious and sensible remark, in case one occurred to me, without the reader's feeling obliged to consider himself outraged. We cannot keep the same mood day after day. I am liable, someday, to want to print my opinion on jurisprudence, or Homeric poetry, or international law, and I shall do it. It will be of small consequence to me, whether the reader survive or not. I shall never go straining after jokes, when in a cheerless mood, so long as the unhackneyed subject of international law is open to me. I will leave all that straining to people who edit professedly and inexorably humorous departments and publications. 3. I have chosen the general title of memoranda for this department, because it is plain and simple, and makes no fraudulent promises. I can print under it statistics, hotel arrivals, or anything that comes handy, without violating faith with the reader. 4. Puns cannot be allowed a place in this department. In offensive ignorance, benignant stupidity, and unostentatious imbecility will always be welcomed, and cheerfully accorded a corner, and even the feeblest humor will be admitted, when we can do no better, but no circumstances, however dismal, will ever be considered a sufficient excuse for the admission of that last and saddest evidence of intellectual poverty, the pun. About smells, in a recent issue of The Independent, the Rev. T. DeWitt Talmage, of Brooklyn, has the following utterance on the subject of smells. I have a good Christian friend who, if he sat in the front pew in church, and a working man should enter the door at the other end, would smell him instantly. My friend is not to blame for the sensitiveness of his nose, any more than you would flog a pointer for being keener on the scent than a stupid watchdog. The fact is, if you had all the churches free, by reason of the mixing up of the common people with the uncommon, you would keep one half of Christendom sick at their stomach. If you are going to kill the church thus with bad smells, I will have nothing to do with this work of evangelization. We have reason to believe that there will be laboring men in heaven, and also a number of Negroes, and Esquimaux, and Pteridophilicans, and Arabs, and a few Indians, and possibly even some Spaniards and Portuguese. All things are possible with God. We shall have all these sorts of people in heaven, but, alas, in getting them, we shall lose the society of Dr. Talmage, which is to say, we shall lose the company of one who could give more real one to celestial society than any other contribution Brooklyn could furnish. And what would eternal happiness be without the doctor? Blissful, unquestionably we know that well enough, but would it be distinct? Apostrophe, would it be re-church without him? St. Matthew without stockings or sandals, St. Jerome bareheaded, and with a coarse brown blanket robe dragging the ground, St. Sebastian with scarcely any raiment at all. These we should see, and should enjoy seeing them, but would we not miss a spike-tailed coat and kids, and turn away regretfully, and say to parties from the Orient, "Colonies are well enough, but you ought to see Talmage of Brooklyn." I fear me that in the better world we shall not even have Dr. Talmage's good Christian friend. For if he were sitting under the glory of the throne, and the keeper of the keys, admitted a Benjamin Franklin or other laboring man, that friend, with his fine natural powers infinitely augmented by emancipation from hampering flesh, would detect him with a single sniff, and immediately take his hat, and ask to be excused. To all outward seeming, the Rev. T. DeWitt Talmage is of the same material as that used in the construction of his early predecessors in the ministry, and yet one feels that there must be a difference somewhere between him and the Savior's first disciples. It may be because here, in the 19th century, Dr. T. has had advantages which Paul and Peter and the others could not and did not have. There was a lack of polish about them, and a looseness of etiquette, and a want of exclusiveness, which one cannot help noticing. They healed the very beggars, and held intercourse with people of a villainous odor every day. If the subject of these remarks had been chosen among the original 12 apostles, he would not have associated with the rest, because he could not have stood the fishy smell of some of his comrades who came from around the Sea of Galilee. He would have resigned his commission with some such remark as he makes in the extract quoted above: "Master, if thou art going to kill the church thus with bad smells, I will have nothing to do with this work of evangelization." He is a disciple, and makes that remark to the master. The only difference is that he makes it in the 19th instead of the 1st century. Is there a choir in Mr. T.'s church? And does it ever occur that they have no better manners than to sing that hymn which is so suggestive of laborers and mechanics? On of the carpenter, receive this humble work of mine? Now, can it be possible that in a handful of centuries the Christian character has fallen away from an imposing heroism that scorned even the stake, the cross, and the axe, to a poor little effeminacy that withers and wilts under an unsavory smell? We are not prepared to believe so, the Reverend Doctor and his friend to the contrary notwithstanding. A couple of sad experiences. When I published a squib recently in which I said I was going to edit an agricultural department in this magazine, I certainly did not desire to deceive anybody. I had not the remotest desire to play upon anyone's confidence with a practical joke, for he is a pitiful creature indeed who will degrade the dignity of his humanity to the contriving of the witless inventions that go by that name. I purposely wrote the thing as absurdly and as extravagantly as it could be written, in order to be sure and not mislead hurried or heedless readers. For I spoke of launching a triumphal barge upon a desert, and planting a tree of prosperity in a mine, a tree whose fragrance should slake the thirst of the naked, and whose branches should spread abroad till they washed the choria of, etc., etc. I thought that manifest lunacy like that would protect the reader. But to make assurance absolute, and show that I did not, and could not seriously mean to attempt an agricultural department. I stated distinctly in my postscript that I did not know anything about agriculture. But alas, right there is where I made my worst mistake, for that remark seems to have recommended my proposed agriculture more than anything else. It lets a little light in on me, and I fancy I perceive that the farmers feel a little bored, sometimes, by the oracular profundity of agricultural editors who know it all. In fact, one of my correspondents suggests this, for that unhappy squib has deluged me with letters about potatoes, and cabbages, and hominy, and vermicelli, and macaroni, and all the other fruits, cereals, and vegetables that ever grew on earth. And if I get done answering questions about the best way of raising these things, before I go raving crazy, I shall be thankful, and shall never write obscurely for fun anymore. Shall I tell the real reason why I have unintentionally succeeded in fooling so many people? It is because some of them only read a little of the squib I wrote and jumped to the conclusion that it was serious, and the rest did not read it at all, but heard of my agricultural venture at second hand. Those cases I could not guard against, of course. To write a burlesque so wild that its pretended facts will not be accepted in perfect good faith by somebody is very nearly an impossible thing to do. It is because, in some instances, the reader is a person who never tries to deceive anybody himself, and therefore is not expecting anyone to wantonly practice a deception upon him. And in this case, the only person dishonored is the man who wrote the burlesque. Another Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.